Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Albert Morales, and this morning's conversation is with Tyler Duvall, Assistant Secretary, Transportation Policy at the U.S. Department of Transportation. Also joining us in our conversation from IBM is Pete Boyer. Tyler, how do you account for the increasing interest of the private sector investing in U.S. highways and public transportation? Specifically, what factors lead to the rise of private sector interest in financing U.S. surface transportation infrastructure?
Right, right, Albert. This is, in my view, one of the most exciting and fascinating areas of policy right now in all of government and obviously within transportation. I think it's one of the most important policy issues. There's a confluence of factors that have taken place in the last, I'd say, 18 to 24 months that have really propelled us to this point where the private sector around the globe is looking to invest in U.S. infrastructure, highways, airports, seaports, and public transportation systems. First and foremost, I would say, is the declining state of the nation's transportation systems, the performance that I referred to, the congestion, the growth in costs associated with the transportation system failures have really propelled state governments to look for new ways to invest in those systems, to expand them, to manage them more efficiently. At the same time that's happening, there's been a flattening out, obviously, of revenues associated with taxes that traditionally go into transportation, and those include gasoline taxes, diesel taxes. We are seeing, frankly, for the first time in about 30 years, a flattening of travel demand in the United States that's producing fewer revenues for state governments. So the revenues available to state governments to improve these transportation systems has flattened at the exact moment that the private sector around the globe has started to amass capital for long-term investments. And so as I mentioned earlier, major pension funds across the world, major long-term investors are really looking at infrastructure broadly, but transportation specifically, as a good intermediate investment tool between, I would say, a real estate investment and a treasury bond. And so if you can earn returns in the 9 to 14% range on these assets, you can really supply very stable revenues to investors over a long period of time. And by long period, I mean, you know, 40 to 75 year investment horizons we're looking at here. So these things have all come together. And then I think the other critical component is what we were just talking about previously. The technology to charge people and generate those revenues has emerged also within the last 2 to 5 years in a very exciting way. So it's really just this confluence of forces that have emerge at the exact moment. Now, the policy and political issues are substantial, and we at the U.S. Department of Transportation have focused heavily on ensuring, obviously, that the policy mechanisms done to do this are done in a way that benefits drivers, users, and investors, obviously, are part of this too. And I think, you know, if I had to kind of rank the policy issues, the first and most pressing issue is how do you regulate the pricing of the system itself? And we have seen in other areas, obviously, regulated utilities like telecom and electricity, that you've got a private entity that provides the core service and then a government entity that regulates how they price it and how they charge for it. Through contracts, long-term agreements with the public and private sector, the same mechanism is emerging in transportation. So several major transactions have already been completed, one in Chicago, one in Indiana for existing toll roads. And these are long-term leases of those roads to the private sector in exchange for very large upfront payments of cash that the public sector can then reinvest in other things. And we are seeing major development of new highways. The state of Texas is building a number of extremely large new highways using extensively or entirely private capital to pay for the upfront costs. And in fact, some of these private entities are actually paying Texas for the right to construct these facilities. The most important policy question is do the prices that are prescribed or regulated under that contract, do they relate to the costs, the risks of investing in these assets? Do they provide a windfall to the private sector that drivers bear the costs of? And I think what we're seeing is the emergence of a regulatory regime through contracts, and that includes, you know, basically regulations in the contract dictating what prices can be charged and when they can be charged. And we have obviously been supportive of ensuring that the public interest is protected in connection with these. But what we don't want to do is constrain the innovation in the development of infrastructure by unnecessarily regulating state and local governments. And, you know, we've got a large tension, I think, emerging at the federal level about what is the role of the federal government in regulating these transactions at a state and local level. And I think our view in the administration is that governors, state leaders are well equipped to judge the public interest considerations on their own, that the federal government's role should basically be to disclose information, provide expertise, and to the extent we're providing grants or loans to those projects, which is something that we do, that we insist on, you know, the public interest factors being taken into account. So it's a very exciting time. The conservative number I've heard is that about $100 billion of capital has been formed around the globe in equity that could be levered up to about $400 billion. So they're tremendous money. The real question is, can you get the policy framework correct to deploy it into the system?
Tyler, as you previously mentioned, the Urban Partnership Program is part of the Bush administration's comprehensive initiative launched in May 2006 to confront and address congestion through the nation's transportation system. Would you elaborate on the specifics of the UPP and how do the Urban Partnership Agreements enable cities to implement broad congestion pricing or variable toll demonstrations?
Right. This was probably the focal point, the most significant of all the elements of this major congestion initiative that we've undertaken. And the Secretary, Mary Peters, announced in August that we had selected five cities nationwide to pursue demonstrations. And I think that's the important point here, is that we are at a moment of demonstration in the United States. We have seen tremendous system performance problems emerge in our major cities, as I said. And it's time that we recognize that embracing demonstrations or experiments is what we need to do, that we're not announcing that this is a wholesale shift of policy that's needed, but we do need to be willing to experiment. And what we said to major cities is that we've got four areas of experimentation we'd like you to pursue. And in exchange for that, we'll offer you federal grants, federal loan assistance if you have projects that you need loans on, process streamlining for decision making, and obviously departmental political expertise, experience, support. That's the package of support we had. We had approximately $1 billion in assistance we made available. And I think this was one of the great success stories from my perspective, was that we cobbled together, I think, approximately 13 different programs, all of which were considered standalone programs with broad eligibility to improve transportation. And we said, and these were housed under the Federal Transit Administration and the Federal Highway Administration. And so what we said is, let's pool these programs together, invest them on a strategic way, not on a peanut butter approach, as the Secretary says, which is, you know, investing small amounts in every city in America. We said, let's do a strategic investment to encourage demonstrations. And the four areas, as I mentioned, that we really want to see these cities focus on is variable tolling. We want to demonstrate to the world that this concept of variable tolling works, that they like it, that the public will accept it. That is the central element of the Urban Partnership Program. And the most comprehensive proposal we got was in the city of New York. Other elements are very important too, because what we've said is that highway pricing needs to be combined with a transit policy in urban areas that accommodates free flow conditions on the highways. Obviously, rail systems are important. We need to keep investing in our rail systems. But once you create free flow conditions on a highway, you can really expand the opportunity to improve speeds of buses in particular. You know, there's a classic stigma, I think, that a lot of people don't want to ride buses, that they're not clean, they don't function correctly, they're not on time. Well, one of the problems is congestion itself. And so what we have found throughout the world is that if you can create free flow conditions on highways, you have high-tech clean buses, people will ride them. If you can go 65 miles an hour on a highway, you're more likely to take a bus. Nobody wants to sit on a bus any more than they want to sit on the car in traffic. So what we want to do is probe that even further and see if we can integrate this highway pricing concept with high-speed public transportation during peak periods. So those are the two main elements. And then the other elements are to really get employers and states realizing that technology can be an enabling force to allow flex scheduling of workers. We have already seen that in the federal government. In fact, for those of us who commute on Fridays in Washington, D.C., we see the benefits of flex scheduling by the federal government. Very small percentages of federal employees taking what they call regular day off, you know, working 9 days out of 10, produces huge increases in traffic. I just drove in on Friday the other day, free flow conditions, the Thursday conditions were significantly worse. That is almost entirely as a result of the federal telecommuting policies or flex scheduling policies. A lot of employees love telecommuting. A lot of employers are nervous about it. What we've said is technology obviously can allow not only telecommuting, but basically staggered work schedules. And very small percentages of traffic removed during peak periods produce huge increases in traffic speeds. The numbers we have internally are about 5 to 8% reduction in traffic can reduce congestion by about 50%. So we're very close to solving most of the urban congestion problems. And then again, finally, real-time traffic. Not only do you need to provide more free flow conditions, but you need to provide drivers and users of the system more information about how that system is performing. We have great information about virtually every area of our lives. In fact, we have information overload in many areas of our life, but we are relatively ignorant about how our transportation systems are performing on an hour-by-hour, minute-by-minute basis. Again, that's not a technology problem. The technology is widely available now to start doing that, it's really a political and a policy problem to get that implemented. So we announced these cities. New York City, I think it's safe to say, was the most comprehensive. Mayor Bloomberg announced that he's proposing basically what's called a cordon toll, drawing a ring around the center of Manhattan, and he wants to charge people $8 a day to cross into the center of Manhattan. He's run travel numbers that basically show a significant reduction in congestion associated with that, that people will respond by either taking mass transit, traveling during different hours. His proposal is 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., I believe, are the times associated with his proposal, or basically telecommuting or working from home, you know, through technology. And I think it's not clear exactly what each person would do, but what's clear is the shifts would be significant. They are now, as we speak, debating this exact concept in New York City. There's been a commission formed to decide on whether to proceed. We have given them a deadline of the end of March to get legislative approval to do this. If they get legislative approval, they will get approximately $350 million of federal funds. If they don't, those funds will be reallocated to other cities willing to pursue similar demonstrations. That's the most comprehensive, but it's also important to note that four other cities, as I mentioned, Seattle, San Francisco, Miami, and Minneapolis are all pursuing, I would say, smaller concepts related to this concept of pricing and integrating transit policies. And we will see that play out over the next 2 years. The theme of the initiative, just to be clear, was that we can solve congestion in the short term, that this is not – we don't need to have a 25-year capital plan to really start to reduce traffic congestion. And I think we are on the cusp of demonstrating that, and we're very excited about what each of these cities is doing.
Now, Tyler, using your New York example, the mayor not only has called for the cordon pricing as a way of mitigating traffic congestion, but he also stated it as part of a broader sustainability plan to create the first environmentally sustainable 21st century city. So to what extent is tackling traffic congestion not only good transportation policy but also good environmental policy?
That is a great question, Albert. And it's in an era, obviously, where environmental considerations have become, you know, front page news and as they should be. I think this is the great link that has been missing in the major public policy debates here in Washington, and that it is about to emerge. And I think Mayor Bloomberg was absolutely right to talk about the health benefits, the air quality benefits associated with reducing traffic. And it's not simply the idling vehicles, which obviously pollute more than vehicles running on more free-flow conditions. It's also the start-stop cycle associated with congestion produces more accidents, and it also emits more and it consumes significantly more fuel. We've done some internal analysis at the department about the fuel savings associated with some major pricing demonstrations, and I think in our view, you would save approximately the same amount of fuel that we will save under a major new fuel economy regulation that the department put out for light trucks in 2006. That you would save approximately the same amount of fuel by simply doing congestion pricing in 2 to 3 major U.S. cities. So enormous fuel being wasted in congestion. And obviously the fuel waste correlates extensively to greenhouse gas emissions, to the emissions of traditional pollutants. So what we have found, interestingly enough, is that the environmental community has been one of our biggest proponents. And we've got the environmental defense organizations. We've got the Sierra Club. Major other environmental organizations are looking at the inefficiency of transportation systems as a great mechanism to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I think that traditionally we've looked at the fuels themselves and the vehicles, but this is kind of the third prong of the environmental test. And we are very supportive, obviously, of telling the world about the environmental benefits of this concept.
It's fantastic because clearly there is a linkage there. What does the future hold for U.S. transportation policy? We will ask Tyler Duvall, Assistant Secretary of Transportation Policy at the U.S. Department of Transportation, to share with us when the conversation about management continues on the Business of Government Hour.